This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yves Wahib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
each voyage was able to generate between 30,000 and 70,000 euros. So that's an enormous amount of money.
That's journalist Josephine McKenna in Rome reporting on a people smuggling ring Italian police have broken up. Details coming up.
Also, according to a UN report, thousands of inmates in Libya have been held without charge since longtime Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown in 2011. The art scene in the DRC is vibrant and flourishing, and South Sudan's former chief of staff says he is forming a new rebel movement called the South Sudan United Front.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story: for the past several years, thousands of migrants from Africa and beyond have undertaken difficult journeys to Europe. Many of them pay smugglers to take them across the Mediterranean Sea, often on rickety boats to Italy. But Italian authorities say they have broken up a different type of trafficking ring, one they are calling a luxury operation. Journalist Josephine McKenna in Rome has been covering the story. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson today.
Early today, Italian police conducted dawn raids in the Sicilian city of Palermo and two other towns in Sicily. 13 people were arrested in this operation, which has been dubbed Scorpion Fish. Now, police say the ring involved Tunisians, Moroccans and Italians, and it was a very highly organized professional operation in which they are alleged to have been ferrying migrants who were paying between 3,000 and 5,000 euros per head from the coast of Tunisia to Sicily.
Now, this ring seems a little bit different from some of the other smuggling rings. You said that they were charging high prices and that they're using sort of fast speed boats to get people instead of some of the more rickety old fishing boats and things like that that we see a lot.
That's correct. The Italians involved in this operation have described it as a kind of a luxury immigrant smuggling ring. Each voyage was able to generate between 30,000 and 70,000 euros. So that's an enormous amount of money. They were also importing hundreds of pounds of contraband cigarettes. And so this was very highly organized. The people being transported were paying a premium, and there's also suggestions of links with jihadists. Now, there's limited information on that so far, but one telephone intercept between one of the organizers and an immigrant saw that the immigrant was speaking about his intention to go to France to carry out what they called dangerous acts from which he may not return. So with the concerns about terrorism internationally, these kinds of voyages really do ring alarm bells because, as the prosecutor said, these migrants were able to bypass any kind of checks on arrival, any kind of checks from the authorities on who they might be and any kind of registration process.
Well, it seems like in this organized operation, these guys were not counting on having aid groups or coast guards intercept and rescue people. What they were counting on was getting in sort of under the radar and dropping people off safely themselves. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think when you consider the extent of the Italian coastline and even the Sicily coastline, it just is an indication of how easy it is really, or it would be that easy for people to get away with this kind of thing. Perhaps we're seeing just the tip of the iceberg. These voyages were highly organized. They stopped usually at another location en route, often stopping at another island called Pantelleria off the coast of Sicily before they docked on the west coast of Sicily, and they had very organized roles within the organization, specific roles where people were dealing with the immigration of the migrants, the collection and the custody of the migrants. Other people were handling the money that was handed over, as well as the maintenance of these very expensive motorboats that were being used for the crossing. So a highly organized operation here, and very different to the others that we've seen off the coast of Libya.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna speaking with our colleague Kate Pound Dawson.
The United Nations says the Libyan government has increasingly relied on armed groups for law enforcement, allowing their power to grow with little to no oversight. As a result, several UN agencies say an estimated 6,500 inmates have been held in official prisons and thousands more in facilities run by these armed groups. The agency's report says the prisoners frequently face torture. The report says many inmates have been held without charge since longtime Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown in 2011. The UN's top refugee official, Zayed Rad Al Hussein, referred to what he called appalling abuses that include beatings with metal bars and electronic shocks. He urged that those responsible for such abuses be brought to justice urgently with help from the international community. The UN report says the government has paid salaries to many of the armed fighters and provided them with uniforms and equipment.
Sub-Saharan Africa has the youngest population in the world, and it is growing rapidly. By 2030, the United Nations estimates the region will be home to a quarter of the world's 15 to 24-year-olds. How will African countries cope with this sizable new generation striving to study and work? Universities on the continent already are overwhelmed. For VOA, Sophia Christensen has the second of three reports on the issue from Senegal's largest public university.
Beads of sweat are visible on Professor Oumar Diaye's face as he teaches French literature via a crackly microphone. The lecture hall is packed. They huddle on the floor and perch on windowsills. Others strain to listen from the outside. I feel exhausted, says Diaye. Even dead if I can say so. But this is the job, and we are driven. It's a typical day for the professor. He teaches four of these big two-hour lectures per week, as well as around 100 seminars, which he either takes on for paltry overtime or delegates to his teaching assistants. Dakar Cheikh Diop University, also known as UCAD, has some 100,000 students, four times its official capacity. In 2017, the student-to-lecturer ratio was a staggering 158-1 for the School of Humanities and 75-1 for the law school. At UCAD, teachers spend more than half the year marking papers, and students wait months for their exam results. Staff shortages and perennial strikes have delayed the academic calendar, pushing the start of classes this school year to as late as February for some students. In 2015, the government hired 210 new teachers for existing university, as part of an ongoing expansion of the higher education system. But staff say this was insufficient, and that it will take years for these new recruits to attain full professor status. It's a challenge the head of Cheikh Anta Diop, Chancellor Ibrahima Tioub, is acutely aware of. He says from one day to the next, they will be asked to execute a profession for which they have not yet been trained, and this will be a problem. Professors also complain about the limited possibilities for research. At UCAD's main library, the shelves are dusty and poorly stocked. African literature professor Ibrahima Diouf says he rarely finds what he needs for his papers. Here, it is not like countries where you can find everything in the library, he says. Even references relating specifically to Senegal can be easier to find abroad. This is why African researchers are often traveling. The university grants its teachers one research trip every 2 years, for which they receive funding to cover travel and other expenses. But many teachers admit they travel more frequently, leaving students like Mohamedou Thio to fare for themselves. He says that sometimes they announce the start of classes, but the teachers don't show up. We sometimes wait up to a month before starting lessons. Space is another issue. Professor Diouf shares the stuffy office of a senior linguistics professor. I would like to say this is my desk, he says, but in reality, I share it with Professor Ba, Professor Li, Professor Sey, Professor Fai, and a few other colleagues. Senegal, like other African countries, is in the midst of a population boom. Demand for university enrollment is expected to increase dramatically over the next decade and beyond. The government has begun recruiting staff for two new universities it is building outside Dakar, scheduled to open later this year. Meantime, professors at Cheikh Diop have their hands full. Sophia Christensen for VOA News, Dakar.
The art scene in the Democratic Republic of Congo is vibrant and flourishing, but talented local artists still struggle for international recognition. VOA's Anita Powell takes us to the studios of some of Kinshasa's top talents.
Eddie Kamwanga Alunga's sweltering Kinshasa studio seems worlds away from his glittering, well-received foreign exhibitions. The 25-year-old painter says he is inspired by his country's vast cultural and mineral wealth, but also its painful colonial history. His dizzyingly bright paintings have been exhibited in South Africa, Europe, and the United States as African art has grown increasingly more popular. One of his pieces can fetch up to $30,000 in an international auction. But that figure is far from his daily reality. He rents his space for $300 a month. His paints have to be imported from Germany. And art industry experts say while those seemingly high prices make him one of Congo's most lucrative artists, his extraordinary work only fetches average prices by international standards. African artists, Ilunga says, are regarded differently on the international art scene, and it is a struggle of many artists in Africa to get the same recognition. Celebrated sculptor Freddy Tsimba says one problem is the lack of support at home. His captivating works of haunting human figures shaped of discarded items like bullet casings, keys, and spoons are shown internationally, but get little notice in Congo. There is no shortage of artwork in Congo. Original pieces and antique crafts sell for a song at the bustling Kinshasa art market. But high-end art is rare, says local art promoter Fabrice Bashonga.
Congolese art is going very cheap in the international market, mainly because of the lack of consideration locally.
Artist Vichwa Mulambe Bondo has exhibited and lived around the world, but he returned home despite the challenges. He works at a recently established incubator for young Congolese talent.
I said, okay, it's good for me to stay here. Why? Because we need to build art scene and to make something sense and the people can buy artwork in Congo. And now these people start to buy, but it's a process, it's a big challenge.
The studio also features a rare sight on the Congolese art landscape, two women artists. Dina Ikanga, who creates images by pounding nails into a board to make the shape of human figures, is one of 10 artists in residence. It is not easy at all, she says, because the men push you around a bit from all sides, and especially in the Congolese art scene, the market is rather difficult. Younger artists like painter Romario Lucao also say they struggle to establish themselves. He is part of Collective Takei, a group of four young painters whose works shimmer with color and vitality, who are trying to make it together in the art world, selling their paintings for about $1,000 apiece. My biggest dream, Lucao says, is for people to talk about Congolese art the way we talk about American art, the way we talk about German art, the way we talk about Belgian art. But he and other Congolese artists say they are hopeful that bit by bit, stroke by stroke, and line by line, that dream will finally come into focus. Anita Powell, VOA News, Kinshasa.
19 minutes past the hour. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. South Sudan's former chief of staff, General Paul Malong, says he is forming a new rebel movement called the South Sudan United Front. The government of President Salva Kiir in Juba, however, is playing down the announcement. Information Minister Michael Makuei today spoke with Nabil Biagio, a reporter for VOA's South Sudan in Focus. Makuei says the government is not surprised by General Malong's decision to form a rebel movement. Makuei says the government has monitored Malong's activities and the former general is recruiting supporters in Nairobi and Khartoum. Makuei says the ex-army chief was removed from his post because he was planning to stage a coup against President Kiir. After being held under house arrest for several months in Juba, Malong was released for medical reasons last November and now is in Nairobi. Malong's spokesperson told South Sudan in Focus yesterday that the former army chief founded the South Sudan United Front Army to restore democracy and the rule of law in the country.
Now that most African states have signed the basic framework agreement setting up the landmark African Continental Free Trade Area, the work on building its critical elements continues, and several key countries have yet to ink the pact. VOA senior analyst Jeffrey Young discusses the next steps with a top African Union official and economists.
When 44 African leaders gathered in Kigali last month to sign the African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement, the lavish ceremonies represented more of a cornerstone laying than a ribbon cutting marking completion. Much, it turns out, remains to be done via Skype from Nigeria. Economic research Southern Africa economist Nonso Obikili.
The signing in Kigali was not the establishment of a free trade area, but the signing of a legal framework under which the free trade area will happen. So there's still a lot of protocols to be signed, there's still a lot of negotiations to be had.
Two of Africa's biggest economies have not yet signed the agreement. African Union officials say South Africa's formal approval is expected after Pretoria completes a constitutionally mandated review of the deal. In Nigeria, both the country's Labor Congress and the Manufacturers Association opposed the deal as bad for the country. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari says he will consult again with those groups before moving forward. But a top African Union official says removing tariffs provides greater and more broad-based economic benefits than protectionism offers. Via Skype from Addis Ababa, Commissioner for Trade and Industry Albert Muchanga.
And when that is done, it means that the goods will be much cheaper because there will be less the duty that has been that used to be applied. And that is going to stimulate enhance the production across Africa.
The United Nations estimates that under the deal, African states will lose a collective $4.1 billion in tariff revenue a year. However, it says lower prices will produce what it calls a social benefit to consumers of more than $16 billion annually. Trade between African states amounted to just 10% of the continent's total trade in 2010. The UN's Economic Commission for Africa says that by 2022, the Free Trade Pact could increase inter-African trade by up to 52%. Much of Africa was liberated from colonialism more than a half century ago, but some old practices remain. The chairman of the Institute of Economic Affairs says Africa's development depends on open commerce, not protectionism and favoritism. From Accra via Skype, Charles Mensah.
What we are doing now is practicing the same old mercantilist economy, the colonial economy, where our government creates rents for business people to extract.
With this free trade pact, African states essentially give up part of their sovereignty to enjoy collective benefits. And that, according to some regional analysts, emotionally goes against the fierce nationalism that drove their gaining freedom. Jeffrey Young, VOA News, Washington.
Why don't I just fire Mueller? Well, I think it's a disgrace what's going on. We'll see what happens. But I think it's really a sad situation when you look at what happened. And many people have said you should fire him.
That was U.S. President Donald Trump talking about Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller, who is investigating his campaign. The comments came as the FBI searched the home and offices of Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, yesterday. Today, the president railed again about the FBI raids with a tweet saying, "Total witch hunt." The FBI seized some documents related to Trump's alleged affair with an adult film star. Cohen says he paid the actress $130,000 before the 2016 election to keep quiet about an affair she allegedly had with Trump. The president says he was unaware of the payment. Cohen's attorney, Stephen Ryan, says the search was based in part on a referral from Mueller to federal prosecutors in New York, including a U.S. attorney appointed this year by Trump's attorney general. A federal judge approved the search. Since Mueller's probe is focused on Russian election interference that allegedly backed Trump, under law he needs approval from top Justice Department officials if he discovered something else during the probe that he deemed worth investigating.
UN agencies report an alarming escalation of humanitarian need in war-torn Syria as violence, displacement, and the suffering of the Syrian people reach new heights. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
While people throughout Syria are in desperate need of humanitarian assistance and protection, UN agencies say they are particularly concerned about tens of thousands of civilians trapped in Douma, a town inside eastern Ghouta in the suburbs of Damascus. Dozens of people reportedly were killed during an alleged chemical attack Saturday in Douma. Spokesman for the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says the United Nations has no access to eastern Ghouta, which is still under siege. He says the United Nations can neither confirm nor deny a chemical attack occurred.
We are in place outside of eastern Ghouta in those eight centers where we can provide some aid. We are not in eastern Ghouta. And for this, as you say, extremely serious allegations with very severe ramifications, political, military, and otherwise, we need to be absolutely sure that what we say is correct.
The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 133,000 people have fled eastern Ghouta during the past 4 weeks. Spokesman Andrei Mahechich says the UNHCR is working with UN and private agencies to help improve the substandard conditions at these collective shelters. He says the displaced are in great need of everything, as they have fled their homes with nothing.
It is particularly difficult for women and children. As you can imagine, if you have only the clothes you wear, you have nowhere to wash them, you have nowhere to change, you have no way of keeping your personal hygiene. And this only adds to all of the risks that these people have been already exposed to and are currently exposed to in the congested shelters.
The UNHCR estimates 44,000, mainly women, children, and elderly, have completed their security screening and have been allowed to leave the collective shelters. The agency says no constraints should be put on the freedom of movement of civilians. It says they should be free to choose where they wish to go once they leave the centers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Linus Rimkus, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
I'm Lee Normadou, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, We will discuss some basic steps you can take to help you stay in good health when traveling. Our guest is Dr. Ken Red Cross, internal medicine specialist and concierge doctor. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.